Welcome to Man Reads Monday. I am Aaron Ventura. He is Jacob Rush. Let's get to work. Jacob, what are we working through today?
Today we're in chapter... Okay, this is weird. It doesn't tell me the chapters in my little Kindle thing. But what is it? 10?
10.
Okay.
And 11.
10 and 11 of Joe Rigney's More Than a Battle, How to Experience Victory, Healing, and...
You had that out of
freedom.
Order. How to experience victory, freedom and healing from lust.
From lust.
Yes. So do you have the titles in your little Kindle?
No. It just says More Than a Battle at the top.
Oh, okay. Man. So someone was slacking Kindle formatting.
This is lazy Kindle work right now.
If you want to grab a hard copy, there's one right there. But I will read the title. So we're into what almost could be considered appendices. Now, so we finished looking at the war from the wider, the subtler, the longer war. Did I ever say that? Deeper war. And... now we're just into a few words. These are just kind of like exhortations targeted at different groups of people. And so chapter 10 is a word to young men, single, dating, and engaged. And I think he said young men, he's saying middle school through college, basically. So I guess I'm no longer a young man. And then
what?
And then chapter 11 is a word to married men. This really funny, I shouldn't say funny, but it is kind of funny. The way he describes it, this dynamic between the watchdog and the caged animal.
Yeah.
So let's start in chapter 10. I figure we'll just hit a few of these things.
Yeah, some of it is like...
we've hit it before.
Yeah, and the stuff, whether in this book or in like Solomon Says, but...
Self-mastery, rule your belly.
Rule your belly, yep.
So what was your big takeaway from chapter 10?
I think this is where Joe does a really good job at synthesizing a lot of the sources that he's, you know, that we're familiar with.
Yeah, you can hear
Pastor
other
Doug.
People in this.
Yeah, Pastor Doug and a couple of other folks. If you haven't read it, it's actually a really good little book of essays called How to Exasperate Your Wife.
Okay, yep.
Which...
that's a funny cover.
Yeah, it's like the guy on the couch like in a Speedo, a cheetah Speedo. Anyway, but it's a really good book with short little essays, and a lot of that... even this in these appendices, I think are kind of combined wisdom.
Yeah.
Like the
whole
sayings,
nuisance lust idea, I think, comes from Doug's book.
Yeah. The sayings of the wise, the words of the wise and their riddles.
Yeah.
I think what I really appreciate about this is, again, emphasizing this thing of, I wish that I had this book 10 years ago. 15 years ago. And telling you the kind of things that I wish I'd had. So he talks about, you know, faithful fathers and accountability. Because how many times do I remember being in my high school youth group? And and some of it is, it's not that I didn't have mentors available, but my whole mindset of approaching fighting the sin was backwards, right? Where you just go, your huddles were failure huddles.
Yeah.
Right. You know.
How'd everyone do this week? Terrible.
Terrible.
All right. See you next week.
Yeah. Because you were surrounding yourself, and this tends to be the problem in evangelical churches, is you surround yourselves with those who are like you, and you get siloed off into these different peer groups, as opposed to being integrated into a larger church body and church community, where you have men who are older than you, men who are wiser than you, men who have achieved victory and who are more holy, you know, holy than you, and have had these experiences. And I think that's one of the strongest exhortations that I would give, is like, especially if you're a young man in that age, right, of high school and even in college. Build those relationships with men who are older than you, men who don't have, it's not that they don't have these struggles, but they've gone
they're farther along in them,
If the whole premise of this is that this is a longer war, and you're going to have different stages of the war. You're going to have guys who are 50 miles ahead of you on the long march.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to hang out with them. It makes sense to get their feedback. It makes sense that they are going to be the ones who are going to be most helpful to you rather than your buddies, rather than the guys who are going to have the same struggle. So I really appreciated that. And again, it made me like, oh, I wish that I had read this book before.
Yeah,
Joe, 15 years too late.
It is that idea from Proverbs of just, you become like your teachers. You also become like those you hang out with and those you're around.
Right.
And especially in this age of life, you're pretty much just hanging out with all your bros, and you guys all have the same struggles, and likely there's a lot of failure going on there. And I think part of the trick of this is that you don't see someone's sexual battle, like they don't wear it on their face. Like there's right. like it's in some ways it's invisible.
Yeah.
So the question that I would be asking then is, well, then how do I even know where to look? You make assumptions. You could, let's say you're in some youth group somewhere.
Yeah.
And you assume the youth pastor must have it all figured out. So you go confide in him. But then you find out later on, you know, he was sexually abusing some people, or like,
right.
He's actually a predator. And that can really rock your confidence in leadership. It does make you wonder. I mean, I was in church cultures that it was just unheard of, almost like this unattainable goal of sexual purity. So people would talk about it, but
it was a unicorn.
Yeah, it was kind of like, but we all know that's not actually possible.
Right.
And you kind of get in these cycles of celebratory failure kind of thing. So I think that's a huge deal, is finding mentors who will speak frankly to you.
Yeah.
This is one of the jobs. So just a couple offices over, Matt Gray, who I co-labor with doing all the college ministry stuff. And we just meet with guys all the time. And I mean, this is just one of the things that's going to come up. Mm-hmm. And so him and I are in the place of being like surrogate fathers for people. And maybe you don't have, you don't have kids yet, but you already can imagine that your sexual purity is going to impact your future sons and daughters.
Yeah.
And the stakes are high. And in the same way that I don't want to sit down with a guy and not have any advice, or be giving him advice that I know doesn't work, right? Because if it worked, but if it didn't work for me, why should I think it would work for him?
Right.
And therefore, a lot of guys end up not even giving counsel, or not even going there, because it's a battle that they themselves have not fought and won. And so when I look at my 10-month-old son, and this is one of the other things I've just noticed, I may have said this before, is the sins of fathers gets visited onto the children. And so I've seen this in our community. I see this all over the place, where if the father is having some kind of sexual weirdness sin going on, I can almost guarantee you the son is going to have some kind of porn addiction. It's almost like it's so frequent. It's so common. It's a pattern that I've just noticed.
Yeah.
And that scares me.
Yeah.
Because I think the secret sinful thoughts of my mind can show up in a more blossomed form in my children.
Right.
And that's a terrifying thought. The things that we think are hidden, God often brings to light in our children, because they are our mirrors. And I think if you are either thinking about your children or having children one day, like, marriage raises the stakes. Having children raises the stakes even more. And that we want that to be the good kind of pressure, that pornography would blow up my marriage. Pornography would blow up my children's life as well. It's nothing to play with. But then remembering, where are the battle lines? I can't draw the line at looking at pornography. We have to draw the line at the mental battle. It's the thoughts and things that we're entertaining. And I think having and being around other people who have that same battle line as you is really key. Because if they're just fighting at the level of, okay, well, I didn't masturbate this week, or I didn't look at porn this week, then you're going to find yourself only winning to that degree. So it's like, how pure do you want to be? How holy do you want to be? And can you find those people around? Or are we becoming that kind of person to help others?
Exactly. And that's basically his counsel about self-control and mastery, is learn and become comfortable with, like you're saying, setting the battle line farther back. And even if it doesn't feel like a big victory, learn to see it that way.
Yeah.
Right? Just like learn to, every time you have a lustful thought, go, Lord, forgive me. Sorry. Like, you know, address it. Don't just go, you know, don't just freak out and then don't do anything with it. You know, even it may scare you and you may stop thinking about it, but address it for what it is. Address it as sin, confess it, and turn from it. And you, that's how you begin to train yourself and train your mind, your conscience, and begin to win those victories that will only compound. If failure compounds, how much more does victory compound? if where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the there's this book I'm reading for the second time now, and it is kind of like a must-read book if you especially are in ministry, but every man should probably read it. But it focuses a lot on like preaching and stuff. But it's called Power Through Prayer by E.M. Bounds. Mm. And this is the most motivational book I've ever read on praying, because he's just talking about how as like your sermon, your preaching, ministry, the power in the pulpit, your ability to preach, it comes from your own, like God's work of holiness in your life. And so you read this book, and for me as a preacher, I think, well, I want to preach well, I want to preach powerfully. Well, where does the power come from? God's power flows through pure vessels.
Yeah.
And in this book, he's specifically talking about the role that prayer plays in a man's walk. And so that's the kind of motivation we need where, like, frankly, reading this book is not very fun for me because it's making me think about all of these, you know, my past sexual sins, my current sin struggles and places I want to grow. I'm thinking about my son, and then I'm driving down the street and then I see a girl and I think about this book. And I'm, so it's just like,
no.
It's just putting it more in my face.
Yeah.
And in some ways I'm like, I'm looking forward to not thinking about even fighting sexual sin because it's making me think about sex, right? It's like, how do you, he mentions elsewhere in here, it's like, in if you've ever seen the movie Inception, and he says, don't think about an elephant. What are you thinking about? An elephant. Yeah. And that's one of the struggles here is don't think about sexual sin. Don't think about your struggles.
Right.
Because there's a way in which you become fixated with it. You're thinking about it. And we actually need to be consumed by something else that is motivating us, right?
And I would actually just, that just reminds me, another quick comment about finding accountability, I almost said partners, but I hate that phrase, mentors and faithful fathers, is run from those who are obsessed with sexual sin.
Well, that's the only one that matters.
Right. That's what I mean. Because I think typically what that reveals is either they've struggled with it intensely and still struggle with it, and so therefore they're not going to be much help, kind of in the same vein, you can't give what you don't have.
Right.
Or they've got a myopic view of sanctification that is actually going to compound your problems rather than help them. And then thinking positively, right, talking about the frustration of reading and just be like thinking about sex. Okay, well then how do you, again, the goal is not simply negative. The goal is for us to pursue. I just finished teaching the sanctification class with some high schoolers, and we read through the Heidelberg Catechism, Ten Commandments. The seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. If you go to the Westminster Larger Catechism, there's a whole list of how you can break it, but also how you can keep it.
Yeah.
And it's by, like, getting married. Loving your wife, like being faithful to your kids, and to the wife of your youth, is actually how you can fight against the sin. And so that's beginning to think in the positive categories, I think, is only going to serve you and to keep you from becoming consumed with the negative.
Yeah.
Right? Don't just take it away, replace it with something good.
Totally. He gives a few words for people who are in the dating or engaged stage of life, and this is one thing that already always comes up is, you know, what are the boundaries? And I just want to read this quote. This is on page 163 because I think this sums everything up. He says, "The fundamental thing you're doing in engagement is demonstrating to your future wife that you're trustworthy. In order to fully and rightly give herself to you in marriage, she needs to trust you. She needs to know you can be confronted by a beautiful woman who is attracted to you and desires you and wants to be with you, and you can resist that temptation. She needs to know you can meet the forbidden woman and walk away. In marriage, you don't know who the forbidden woman will be, but in engagement, you do. You're engaged to her. From the perspective of your future wife, your fiance is the other woman. And then he says on the next, on page 165, so if you're engaged, remember this. No Christian married couple ever wishes they were more physical in engagement, at least not any that I've come across. No godly couple ever looks back and says, I wish we were less prudish during our engagement. I wish we had pushed more boundaries together. Instead, the most common thing you'll hear from many is, why couldn't we have waited? Why couldn't we have held off? Wouldn't our early months of marriage together have been sweeter if we had laid a foundation of trust, stability, and godliness with each other? Mm-hmm. That's the opportunity that dating and engagement provides. I think that's huge. I mean, I can't really improve upon that.
No, that's good. And that's similar to what Pastor Doug says in his premarital counseling, is like you are walking from the shallow end of the pool into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah. Where you will drown. Marriage is drowning. In this metaphor, is marriage dying?
Death. Dying is gain. But what you don't want, and I think even Pastor Toby in his book talks about this concept of physical intimacy and purity in engagement, about unrolling a rug.
Yeah.
Like on one side, you know, think about a rolled up rug. On one side is like emotional intimacy,
yeah,
and spiritual, physical. It's all, yeah. But if you torque one end, you know, it's going to only compound. And so you've got to be aware with how your emotional intimacy can make it actually more difficult for you to resist, yeah, physical intimacy, or vice versa. And which is why you want to, in the metaphor of walking towards the deep end of the pool, that's what engagement is for, and which is why you want to have a short engagement if possible.
Yeah, knowing when the terminal date is, like when is the wedding day, will help you figure out what is the pace, not just of physical boundaries, but of spiritual and emotional ones. So
right.
That takes a certain level, I mean, this takes immense wisdom.
Yeah.
From you, the man pursuing the woman, to know what pace do I need to drive this at? Mm-hmm. Is she fearful and hesitant? Do I need to be the one pushing and challenging her, or do I need to pull back because she's mm-hmm. good? Because a good woman is going to respond to masculine leadership in the right way, but it's also going to create the things that turn a man on and the things that turn women on are different. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so, tell us more.
So some of the stuff that to us is totally non-sexual, for the woman, it's creating that kind of, it's like the emotional foreplay,
right,
for sex. Mm-hmm. So if you're praying together and holding hands and doing all of these sweet things, mm-hmm. that's the kind of like foreplay,
right,
stuff,
yeah,
for a godly woman,
right,
that you would want to actually avoid, restrain yourself from doing too early.
Right.
So you need to know there's a time for when the flowers come on. There's a time mm-hmm. when you should be reading your Bible together and mm-hmm. you know, talking about all this stuff. But also there's a time to be,
yeah,
making sure you're not going too fast.
Yeah.
So the last section is a word to mentors, and this is on, do you confess? Should I confess my sexual sin to my girlfriend? Or mm-hmm. I suppose in a certain sense, it could be your fiance. And he basically boils it down to no, probably not. It's rare when you should confess this kind of thing to her. I think probably the only time he gives these two questions at the end for people. What will help each of these people love God and grow in holiness? So will confessing your porn habit to your girlfriend help both of you? Well, she is in no place to really help you, nor is that a burden she can carry. Mm-hmm. And then the second question is, what will help each of these people determine whether they ought to get married to each other? And I think that's the question where sometimes it would be appropriate to, if you're like, I just am a mess. So, like I do not have any self-mastery, no sexual self-control. Mm-hmm. Then you probably need to break things off,
right,
or put things on hold. And you can give her a little. Don't give her all the details, but you right. can, you, yeah. you can say,
and
hey,
dump everything.
I just don't have self-control in this area yet that I want to be in, and so
right.
That's. It's not like marriage is this magic wand that, like, once you're married, yeah, suddenly all your porn habit goes away. It's not.
And you don't want to transfer your porn habit to your girlfriend or to your so, life.
So yeah, so he basically says you probably need some wise mentor who knows you, knows the situation. So as much as I'd love to just be able to give easy answer to when and what, like what's appropriate, what's not.
Ask your pastor.
Yeah, ask your pastor. And if you don't have a person or a pastor around you that can help you, then you probably need a new church.
I need to move.
You need to move.
What are you doing?
Just don't come to Moscow. Too many people moving to Moscow.
Yeah, yeah. unless you're going to come, bring something good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Chapter 11 is a word to married men, the watchdog, and the caged animal. Jacob, do you want to just give us the description of who's the watchdog and who is the caged animal in this situation?
Yeah. So basically, this chapter is kind of humorous. I mean, but it is also really sad because
you know people like this. Yes, or you know situations like this.
Basically, he's describing the dynamic between a husband and a wife that often comes into play around the husband's sexual sin and the temptations thereof, right? And what's interesting is he says, okay, this condition applies not only when there is ongoing porn use or there's like sexual sin, but even afterwards, even when he's kind of conquered it, you can fall into this dynamic at any rate. And his point is that it's a damaging dynamic. It's not a helpful way to react to one another. So categorize this over how not to interact with your spouse.
Yes.
Right? So the watchdog is the wife, right? So the watchdog is the wife and the caged animal is the husband. And the essence of this dynamic is because of whether the husband's failure or his looking at porn or whatever, what that does is it triggers an insecurity, rightly so, in the wife, like, oh, am I not enough?
Sexy enough for you.
So it triggers this insecurity, which is understandable and, there's a breach of trust there.
Yeah.
But then what then happens is then the wife then begins to eye the husband like a hawk.
Yeah. It says hypervigilant, identifying sexual temptation wherever they go. In other words, she becomes a watchdog.
Doug gives this example in, I think it's the Nuisance Lust, where he's talking about the husband and wife walking through a mall, right? And you see this, girl not wearing anything bouncing along in front of him. and there's the different reactions available to the guy.
Yeah.
In a watchdog and caged animal dynamic, what the wife wants the husband to do is to go, just red alert, like, oh my goodness.
We are leaving this mall and filing a complaint.
Yeah, can you believe people these days? And what that does is it's playing into her anxiety, her hypervigilance. And the key here is how that then affects him.
Yeah.
So his sin triggers her anxieties. Her anxieties makes her double down on him, which then makes his ability to actually deal with sexual temptation that much worse. And in fact, even when he's not dealing with sexual temptation, it actually creates opportunities for there to be sexual temptation because you're spoiling the relationship.
And you're always thinking about it.
Yeah. You're ruining.
Your wife, or in this situation, your wife becomes like this little voice in your head. So when you're walking down the street and then you see an attractive person, you are first having your thoughts, but then you also have, what is my wife thinking about what I'm thinking right now?
Right.
And then you're stuck in this loop where, like, no one can be normal. Like, that it creates all kinds of awkwardness where you're like, what do I do? I look. If I don't look, then she knows that I think she's pretty. But if I look, then I sin because I looked.
You lose both ways.
Right. So it's a lose-lose situation.
And he gives the example about how men and women communicate and some of the difficulties here. And some of it is just a difference between guys and girls. I want to read the little conversation between
him and his wife.
Yep. So, so this is just a hypothetical situation. So what happens when you're living in this dynamic of watchdog and the caged animal? you've got the husband responding to the anxiety of her wife, who then tries to alter his behavior to keep her from freaking out. And then he says, so then you get something like this from the wife. Why are you always rude to my friends? I'm not rude to your friends. Yes, you are. You don't smile at them. You won't talk to them. You look angry whenever they walk up. No, I don't. Yes, you do. Well, if I do, it's because I don't want you to think I find them attractive. I want you to know that I only have eyes for you. Do you find them attractive? What? No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're nice. Some of them are pretty. And that's why I might be a little standoffish to them. I don't want them or you to get the wrong idea. But I want you to be kind to them. They're my friends. And they think you don't like them. I don't like them. I mean, I don't like them in that way. Just try to be nicer, okay? I will, but I don't know how exactly. It's complicated. I just don't get you. So you can see this, how this dynamic works, where all of a sudden there's this hyper focus on this issue that actually creates friction in the relationship, which then ironically could lead a man or the woman to further or worse sexual sin.
Yeah.
The wife is, her trust and her frustration grows and grows and grows. The husband is actually driven to pornography because he...
just frustrated.
He's just frustrated. So you can basically saying, avoid this.
Yeah. So here's how to break this dynamic, because that's this is a really tricky one. Once you're in this kind of... this is the Friedman. This is all Failure of Nerve, Edwin Friedman's book. So go read that book and then try to live it out. But so how to break this dynamic? He says, first, we need to make a distinction between a desire for purity and the sin of reactivity. So here the focus is so, as you mentioned earlier, it's exclusively on lust, sexual sin. That's what's on everyone's mind, and therefore it's on everyone's mind. And so we tend to let that steal the headlines. And then he says, but it's this sin of anxiety, the sin of reactivity, that's actually funding the newspaper. So we have to actually repent, confess those sins as well. He says, once again, you need often a third party here, some kind of wise mentor to help basically translate between husband and wife, because often there's this communication breakdown. He gives the example of even how you use the language of attractiveness.
Right.
Is attractive an adjective, saying something objective about someone, just like the sky is pretty is saying something objective about the sky, but... I'm attracted to that woman, says something about you, and then that would be falling into something sinful. So not everyone, when he reads that example, I was tracking more with how his wife thinks about it rather than Joe. And it seems like that's the place that they ended up making that distinction in how they use it. So we also need to know, where are we just miscommunicating? And then the other things he says are established patterns of fidelity. This helps. So if you are getting victory, which that's who this is aimed at, someone who's read this book and is putting this into action. If your wife knows that you have godly mentors that you are getting help from, then that should help remove some of that, that sinful anxiety. Mm. So we're wanting to remove, obstacles or temptations to anxiety for the wife in this situation. Talking also about how men and women are different. And I find this is one of the places where a third party, even this book. So use this book. I plan on having my wife read this at some point, just because, so I can explain to her, like, hey, men are different, women are different. Okay. But to have a third party, she could read this book and be like, oh, I didn't realize that men always thought this way, or, you know, and she knows some of the stuff because I've told it to her, but hearing it from someone else's voice would be helpful, because this isn't just like, I'm not just making this stuff up myself.
You know that men always think this.
Yeah. Only you think this way, right? And then the last way he says of getting out of this is by having a healthy church culture where you can practice having, I don't know if platonic is the right word, but having just healthy asexual or non-sexual interactions with the opposite sex.
Yeah.
So that's actually, I think he points to C.S. Lewis saying, like, that's a huge help for us, is learning to interact with women in a non-sexual way so that that becomes more the norm. And then we want to, in this like hyper-sexualized world, it actually is killing eroticism. It actually kills the erotic, the what is meant to be there between a husband and a wife when everything is out there. So like a culture that is as hyper-sexualized as ours is probably isn't actually having very much sex.
Actually, isn't that's that the crazy that's thing. What George Gilder says in is it George Gilder
In Men and Marriage? Possibly.
Or something like that. But it's actually Lewis's that hideous strength, right?
Yeah.
Right? You've got the I think it's the people on the moon, right? Who were this erotic, they created basically sex bots to for dainty flesh. They had this desire for dainty flesh and now they're sterile.
Yeah.
It's where we're going is like we don't for as porno you know, pornographicized porn how do you say it
pornified I don't
pornified,
know
there you go. As pornified as our culture is nobody's really doing much sex which is really ironic
it's funny the what we would consider almost like a prudish culture is the kind of culture that actually allows for true eroticism within marriage because that's the one place that it's taboo everywhere else it's making a distinction between spaces, holy spaces, you know, Paul says, let the marriage bed be undefiled. Well, if you've defiled everything else, right?
Nothing is
it's,
holy.
Yeah, it's not, if nothing is holy, then the marriage bed is going to be defiled too. And so
it's just something else. You know what I mean? Yeah.
And so this is one of the places culturally, as a culture, we got to figure out what are the ways that our norms that like your average Netflix show that is produced now basically has like soft porn in it, right? The so-called PG-13 stuff now is basically pornographic.
Yeah.
So like I'm thinking about how do I shepherd my family, especially like my kids, through the like entertainment standards we have at home. And so something that because men and women are different, something that like my wife may not think at all like this, you know, a woman with her cleavage, you know, showing so much. I'm like, okay, I'm a guy. I know how a guy thinks about that. I know that I don't want to put that in front of my son. And for a lot of us, that's going to just mean we can't really like watch anything produced in this in the last in 50 years however long. We've been watching like these old Jane Austen
BBC.
Some of the BBC Cranford ones. But even some of those are like, you know, a lot of them are very unattractive women, but it's like they got their like whole breasts like all hanging out in some of their clothes. You know, they go to these balls and stuff. And you're like, who like dresses that way? You're not allowed to show any, you know, calves or legs, but it's like the cleavage is all up in the face. And so I'm just like, all right, yeah, I don't think that our kids will be watching
it's
this anytime soon.
It's just animated movies, right? It's just Disney and Pixar.
It's only Hello Ninja.
Before 2010, all the Disney movies.
Yeah.
No, that's, and I think one of the other things in this dynamic is, and again, to kind of go the Friedman route of, the best thing you can do in an anxious system is to have a non-anxious presence.
Yeah.
And in Doug's essay, he, you know, in the mall example, the girl bouncing in front of him, you've got the ACK reaction. But he said, so suppose you had two guys, you put two different guys in the scenario. One guy goes ACK, the other guy kind of laughs, it turns to his wife and says, isn't America great? Like he says, that guy is probably handling it more maturely than the guy who had the big show of fear because he's not concerned about it. And part of what we have to do, tying it into your comment about entertainment standards and the next generation of the kids is there's a sense in which if you can not freak out, And be frank, be blunt, just be like, oh, that's evil. The reason why somebody does that is because somebody didn't love them. No man is protecting her. sex is great in marriage. You know, there's almost a way if some of the shrillness of the evangelical culture, the purity culture, has actually functioned to drive people into the place they are now.
Yeah, it makes me. It makes me think of someone who is unable to laugh at themselves. So you know this, like, if you're joking around with the guys, and then someone suddenly like takes it personally, takes it seriously, it just, it kind of kills it, right? Yeah. And it's this, it's that same dynamic of like, if you're unable to laugh at yourself, in a certain sense, if you're unable to laugh at the ridiculousness of the, right, the lady in the mall, that is one of the ways of diffusing.
Yes.
It's like, how do you de-escalate a situation? Humor is one of those ways we de-escalate. And we're just like, it goes in and it goes out. It gets recycled. Someone who's taking it very seriously is actually giving it more power by taking it so seriously. So if I see a little spider, or actually some people would do this, so I'll use an ant. If I see an ant crawling across the floor, and I straight up blow up the building to kill the ant. The reason why I changed it, because I know some people, if they saw a spider, they would legit want to do that. Right. We would say, I think that I have a problem of proportion.
Yes.
And so I think it's that same idea when we're fighting temptation to sin. When Paul says to flee youthful lusts, that doesn't mean flee beautiful women.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if it's Potiphar's wife, where she's saying, I want you, like, come lie with me, shikve me, whatever. It's a funny thing in Hebrew. If that's happening, then yeah, you run and you leave your garment. But let's be honest.
No girl is coming up to you, dude.
That's not ever happened to me. It's probably not gonna happen.
Like, unless you're, you know, an exec at some Fortune 500 company,
right?
You know what I mean? It's probably not happening.
So, what are the ways to actually diffuse the situation, to de-escalate it, and manage the anxiety to break out of the cycle? And sometimes is going to be some of that humor.
Yeah.
Okay, Jacob. That's it. We only got one more episode on this as we're finishing this book.
And then what?
We need to talk off air about that. So until next time, Jacob, what should people do?
Well, whatever it is you do this week, you need to make sure that you, by faith, get that wisdom, build that house, rule that big fat belly, and stack dollars for your grandkids.
Get that summer bod in shape.
I'm trying.